Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Good afternoon. I'm glad to see you all here. I'm Jody Fenton. I manage special collections here in the Central Library for the Seattle Public Library. I'm very happy that we have an opportunity to host the Archives Fair, which is up on level 10. If you haven't been up there, I hope you'll all go up and meet some of our local archivists. This afternoon, we have a really interesting speaker who's coming to talk to us about her experiences using some of the archives. Paula Becker is a staff historian for HistoryLink, and she is the co-author with Alan Stein of a new book called The Future Remembered, the 1962 Seattle World's Fair and Its Legacy, and also of a previous book on the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition, Washington's First World's Fair. The new book, The Future Remembered, is the official commemorative book commissioned by the Seattle Center Foundation for the fair's 50th anniversary celebration, which will be available in stores after October 21st. So you're going to get to hear her speak even before the book is hot in the hands of people. Paula's essays for HistoryLink, and I encourage you to read them. This is the free online encyclopedia of Washington State history. Document some really interesting events and history. The dance marathon craze of the 1920s and 30s, war effort knitting on the home front during World Wars I and II, Washington's WPA-era Federal Theater Project units, and the career of the Egg and I author, Betty McDonald, among many other numerous subjects. So Paula, it's my great pleasure to have you here.
Hi, thank you guys so much for having me. It's such an honor to be asked to speak at any event that has to do with archivists or archives or libraries, because I have so much respect for archivists and librarians, and I have so much appreciation because their work helps everyone and especially helps me to do the work that I do. So, how many of you all are archivists or librarians who are here today? Okay, good. I tried to pitch this about mostly toward archivists, but then with some community ideas too. And so how many of the rest of you all have ever been in an archive? Okay, good, for like genealogy or local history research. Is there anyone here who's never been in an archive but wants to explore one? Okay, yay. Has anyone ever donated anything to an archive? That's great. I haven't done too much of that. I had the opportunity, Jody mentioned Betty McDonald, and I had a very, very dear friend who died a few years ago, right after she turned 100, who had been a good friend of Betty's. And she said to me one day, I have some letters that Betty wrote me in the 50s. What should I do with those? And I said, those should go into a local archive, Blanche. So I was able to help facilitate that, and it was interesting. It was very interesting. So this is a cover for my current book that's about to be coming out. And we're not doing PowerPoint today. I'm a little bit old school. we're doing book covers. There's two of them, and they'll kind of go back and forth. So I'm going to speak today mostly about my experiences in local archives working on the two books that I've co-written. And as Jody mentioned, I've also used the archival materials on other essays that I've written for HistoryLink, which has been great. And also researching things that were interesting to me, my house history. A lot of people have done research in archives for house histories, neighborhood history. And those are often similar ideas that first send people into archives to go digging. So what does a researcher find in an archive? And if you're an archivist, Well, you know all this way better than I do, but they find things like letters, diaries, business records, special books that are too rare or precious to be circulated. And I do encourage you, if you're here as a member of the public, to do go up and go to that archives fair. It's very interesting, and there's all kinds of people from historical organizations, large and small, that can get you started on your research. That's the best way to do it. Go in and ask questions. I've never, ever had anything but tons of help from archivists and librarians. So, and also, really, the thing about archives, bottom line, is that without archival holdings, historical research is really not possible. You know, you can Google something, and you can find out what's out there now on the internet. And sometimes there's good stuff, and sometimes those can be little wormholes into archival research. Certainly with HistoryLink, we source all of our essays, so you can go to the bottom of the essay and you can say, oh, they found that at the, you know, Bellevue Historical Society. Okay, I'm going to go visit there. But you've got to go. You've got to go to the source. You've got to go to the well. I want to be able to respond to specific questions about my research and after I talk about the things that I wanted to tell you today. Especially I want to emphasize that to me it's important, having done the research on these two fairs, to also try to help archivists understand from my perspective as a researcher how we can make sure and try to make sure that there's more in archives to document fairs and festivals that will be happening in the future. So, also, I think we all need to think, as we're cleaning out our houses or downsizing or, you know, deciding what to get rid of as individuals, really what the historical significance of that item that we're getting ready to toss might be. And if you have doubts about it, you know, go to your historical society, come to the library, go to an archive and say, you know, these are something I inherited from my mom. They talk about, you know, Ballard's Main Street in 1920, and, you know, I don't have space for them. Do you think anybody would want them? Because that's how stuff gets in there. So I thought I would start by telling you a little bit about myself, and a lot of you know me, many of you know me pretty well. And I don't think there's anybody here from Puget Sound Regional Archives today over in Bellevue. Oh, yes, yes. You are? What's your name? Oh, I'm Paula Becker. Nice to meet you. Oh, I know Midori's on her exciting Italian vacation. Well, so the Washington State Archives Puget Sound Regional Branch has been my sort of touchstone archive, because there's so much material on the 1962 Seattle World's Fair over there. And I was even going to give them a shout out, because we went through the freezing cold December of 2009 over there, where I was in there every day researching, and it was so cold they lost their heat. And it was, if you're working in an archive, a lot of times you have to wear gloves, and usually that's horrible and you kind of hate it as a researcher and they get in your way. I was so glad for the gloves, because it was freezing. We had to wear our coats. That was a bonding experience with that archive. And as some of you know, I'm not an academically trained historian. I would call myself a very lucky autodidact, kind of self-taught. And I say lucky because the way that I started writing for HistoryLink, which is the online encyclopedia of Washington State history, free, and I would encourage you to go and check it out if you never have, is that my work on Betty McDonald, which was really kind of an obsession 10 or 12 years ago, brought me to the attention of Walt Crowley, who was one of the co-founders of HistoryLink. At the time, I was thinking of this research as skip tracing the dead, because I was trying to locate Betty and her family and figure out which houses they'd lived in and when, and I was kind of stalking the dead, which is fun. That's one aspect of historical research that can be very satisfying. And Walt had sort of a gift for sniffing out writers who would get HistoryLink's sort of journalistic approach to creating an online encyclopedia, and he pretty quickly brought me into the fold. And so I've been writing for HistoryLink for 10 years now, first as a contributing editor and now as a staff historian. And it's been for HistoryLink that I wrote, co-wrote the two books, one on the 1909, can we switch to the AYP cover now? Okay. The 1909 Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition, held on the University of Washington campus, researched largely in the archives of the University of Washington Special Collections, which is super cool because if you're researching something that happened actually on that very site, then when you clear your head and come out the door of the library, you have that like, ooh, feeling. And that was fun. And then the book on the 1962 Seattle World's Fair, which is coming out on October 21st. And I'm particularly interested in social history, especially early 20th century social history. But for HistoryLink, I've written, as Jody said, about everything from dance marathons to world's fairs to freeways to libraries to blanket insurance policies. That's not my most interesting essay, in my opinion, but it's out there. So my work before HistoryLink was mostly in the field of performing arts management, which might at first seem unconnected to the idea of writing for an online encyclopedia, but actually it was a very good training ground because understanding the not-for-profit model, by which I mean both knowing how not-for-profits operate, because HistoryLink, of course, is a not-for-profit organization, and also what they need to do within a community to support their mission, which is really important if you're a not-for-profit. And also knowing that there's not going to be a big profit, you know. When you work for a not-for-profit, that's part of the mentality. And that has come very much in handy. And also understanding performance and thinking a lot about performance has been helpful to me because in my work on World's Fairs, I've had to think a lot about what happens at World's Fairs that is performative and what the contract between the people who buy their tickets and come to the World's Fairs and the performers who might or might not be presenting something that's historically accurate or sensitive, culturally sensitive. How much of that is performative? It's been an interesting thing to have a performing arts background when working through all of that. But that's another conversation, but it gets us to the theme of this year's Archives Fair, which is fairs and festivals. And I want to talk a little bit about what I've found in your archives that has given me the materials to work on these books, and on what isn't there in local archives on these two fairs yet. Of course, we always hope that someone's going to come in the door and say, look what I found in a box in my basement, you know, ah, there they are. And also maybe on what we can do as a community to maybe be able to lard archives with the grist that will be useful for future researchers on fairs and festivals that have yet to happen, because that's something that we can do and we should be doing. So I know that all of the archivists here know exactly what's in your collections, and a lot of you know what's in each other's collections, especially for these two fairs, because our community has really come together and coordinated and done a really good job of letting the public know what's out there on these two fairs, especially with the 62 fair. That's starting to happen more and more. It's been exciting to be at the vanguard of all of that, because when my co-author and I kind of wade into the collections, archivists are like, oh, tell us what you find, because there's going to be a lot more people coming who are going to want to know. And that's just part of how it goes, you know, and it needs to be that way, and I love that part of it. So AYP, let's go back to the AYP cover now. There, okay. Unfortunately for this fair, although there's a lot of material at the University of Washington, there's not what I would call a collection of note, meaning everything was saved, a lot of everything was saved and put in one place thoughtfully on purpose in advance, and the materials kept together from the planning of that fair. That didn't happen. What they have primarily is imagery, because Frank Knoll, who was the official photographer of the AYP, had made these amazing glass plate negatives. And if any of you you know, looked at any of the projects that happened during the 2009 centennial, or have looked through my book, or have looked online at the University of Washington at their visual materials that are online. I mean, they're gorgeous, and that's really important. And we have newspaper coverage on that fair, and of course you can find that on microfilm, also at UW. And we have some artifacts, beautiful artifacts, the stuff they sold at that fair, it's like, you know, beautiful. And we have a little bit of reflection from people who were important to making that fair on major anniversaries, but not very much. There's hardly any of that over there. And I have my own theory for why this is the case, which is that there was this guy named Frank Reed, and or Henry Reed. Henry Reed was the director of exploitation, which is my favorite title ever. of course, it means director of publicity, but he was the director of exploitation. Exploitation is a good thing in 1909. He had that job at the Lewis and Clark Exposition in Portland, and so when AYP was being planned, they were like, hey, let's hire Henry Reed. You know, he knows everybody already, and, you know, let's bring him on board. So they brought him up to Seattle, hired him. He was really important. He gave everybody really good advice. He was really helpful. And everybody took his lead for a while. And then before the fair even opened, he had a big pay dispute with the management, and he quit. And he went back to Portland. And he took a lot of his materials with him. And his plan had been, he told the newspaper, to write a book on the AYP, the whole history. I think it was going to be multi-volume, you know, which some of the histories that exist on, like, the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, you know, a foot-long shelf of books, right? Lots and lots of information. So Henry took his information with him, kept it for a really long time. Eventually donated some of it to the Oregon Historical Society, and I used it there, and it was great. But then when you see what the Oregon Historical Society has on the Lewis and Clark Fair, which is all their records, and you see what there is that Henry brought with him, which is some of his paperwork, much of which has to do with how unfairly he was treated by the AYP, you know, management. So, you know, you have to ask yourself when you're reading something in an archive, who put this here, and why did they put it? Just like the famous, you know, when you see a historical marker, the first thing you're supposed to ask yourself is, how long has this been here? Who paid for it to be put here? You know, so you have to put it in context. So with Henry, that was definitely the case. But the terrible thing is that when Henry left Seattle, nobody else apparently took on the job of making sure that they kept track of all those millions of pieces of paper that planning any kind of an event like that generate. And either they got thrown away or they got put somewhere and haven't ever come to light. So all those records for the AYP, they don't exist. So the first thought about fairs of the future or the current, and by fairs I could mean Bumbershoot, I could mean, you know, Northwest Book Fest, any kind of an event like that, is who is keeping track of how it gets put together? So that's a question we can ask ourselves if we're people who are volunteering for it, or if we're on the board, or if we're archivists thinking, wow, I wonder where those materials might eventually end up. I think that that's an important question to ask yourself in advance. The day-to-day record of what organizers tried and they didn't try, and what worked and what didn't work, without a record of that process, it becomes very difficult to tell the story later on, to figure it out. Early on, in any event, the press is not interested. So you're not going to get newspaper articles 4 years out that are going to give you the kind of details. Once the fair starts, yes, you're going to find out every day who played and where they played and, you know, who said what, who visited. But early on, that has to come from archival records or you don't have it. And of course, as I was thinking through all of this, I was realizing that now planning happens digitally, and I don't know what you do about that. I'm sure all of you all who are archivists deal with that and think about that all the time. It scares me to death that there wouldn't be a heap of papers to go and get in a box and put my gloves on and dig into, but that is something, you know, to think about. So once the imagery kicks in, and if it gets saved, pictures of what happened at the fair, our festival. It helps hugely if we know who we're looking at and what they're doing. And this was one of the things that was so helpful with the University of Washington. And any of you who have heard me talk about this before know I'm going to give a shout out to Nicolette Bromberg, who's the visual materials curator over there. And she thought a couple of years before anybody headed into the archives to start working on that fair, she thought, hey, we have all these images, all these glass plate images and prints, you know, by Frank Knoll, and people are going to need to know who's in those pictures, and we don't know. And so she wrote a grant, and the Friends of the Library was able to support the research, and I think some other organizations too. And she put students on the job, she got them looking in the newspaper, and darn if they weren't able to track down really a ton of information that documented who those people were in those beautiful dresses and big hats and all those men, lines of white guys, you know, and the people in loincloths and what they were doing and when they did it. And so anybody who did an AYP project hugely, hugely benefited from her foresight. So that's something that was really helpful, and I think we need to think that the lesson for that is when we're looking ahead at a major anniversary we know is coming down the pike, what the research needs are, that we know that research is going to spike. We hope it's going to spike, you know. That's why people get in there, because they know that there's an anniversary coming up. And it's sort of like, and this is a dumb analogy, but like if you invite the people over for the cookout and you want to have enough hamburger buns and, you know, so just to know what you've got and to make it accessible for people who come in the door, that's important to be ready. And UW isn't the only place where that happened. It happened at lots of different places, but it happened early at UW. And it was very notable to me as a researcher that was like a huge, huge help in the process. But clearly, the more thoroughly that a collection is processed and the more of what's in that collection is going to show up in anybody's research project. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. So now let's go back to the Space Needle cover, because if AYP was, archivally speaking, research famine, then the Century 21 exposition is a feast. It really was a feast. And if deadlines hadn't loomed, and if you're doing a book or any kind of project that documents a specific anniversary, the deadlines loom. But if they hadn't loomed, I would still be over in Bellevue at the Puget Sound Regional Archives, like swimming through all the paperwork and enjoying finding things and reading every single piece of paper that documented that fair and the planning, the operations, the crank letters, because Century 21 exposition generated some absolutely fabulous and hilarious crank letters. It's not fair to call them crank letters, right? These were concerned citizens from around the country. And it seemed like often these were assignments that a classroom teacher had assigned to her students to write to the directors of the fair to protest something. And the kinds of things that these people were protesting, sometimes it was churches, sometimes it was like a whole town, maybe they got together and they wrote these letters. They did not like the fact that the Soviet Union was invited to the fair. That was not good in the early 60s to invite the Soviet Union to the fair. They didn't come, but just the press on the fact that they were invited, not looked on very happily by a lot of people. And then once the fair got going, the fact that there was this Show Street area, which was the adult entertainment area, where, you know, sometimes women were not fully clothed, that was very objectionable. And the partial nudity, even, you know, for people in Seattle was a little shocking, but it seemed to be more shocking for people who were farther away, who didn't know the guys who were planning it and trust that they would make it tasteful. And so there's all these letters. They're really hilarious. We quote a few of them in the book. And it's crazy because, you know, when you're reading this and you have context, you're like, wait a minute, you know, what about the 1938-39 Treasure Island Fair in San Francisco? Because they had Sally Rand's Nude Ranch. And Sally Rand's Nude Ranch was cowgirls on burros with cowgirl hats and boots on, and that's it, right? Much more shocking than Show Street. But my point about Century 21 is that apparently almost everything got saved. I mean, the exposition company's records for the entire, basically 7 years from the beginning to when the fair happened, there in Bellevue, they have 208 cubic feet of it, which is lots. And Michael Sanders knows a whole bunch more about how that all got into one place, because at one point it was at different archives, and then it was gradually sort of brought home to Bellevue, which is a great place for it to be. And what I heard some anecdotes about how that stuff got saved, and it's interesting when you hear these, because it makes you think that, wow, it could easily have ended up in a dumpster. And that's what we don't want to have happen for fairs that are yet to happen. Okay, so the anecdote that I heard, the source is this really great guy named Louis Larson. We interviewed Louis for the book. He's just this fabulous guy. And he worked for the fair first as the director of the advanced ticket sales director. And then he, once the fair opened, he was a special events director. And the fair was going along, and I don't know what made Louis exactly really thinking about, you know, history, or the future and how the fair would be looked at, but he was. And he was high enough up that when he took his concerns to the directors and said, what's going to happen to all this stuff that's in all these drawers and all our planning stuff, you know, where are we going to put that? They were like, well, yeah, what is going to happen? And he said, we need to be sure that gets saved, someplace safe. So what they ended up doing was they issued this memo that if you wanted to get your final paycheck, you had to turn in your folders, you had to turn in your files. And everyone wanted their final paycheck, so they did. Now, I don't know if that's really true or not. I hope it's true, because I think it's a fabulous story, and I think it's a brilliant idea. And the records are there, right? So they did get saved. And Louis Larson cared so much about those records that he said to me, yeah, he goes, I went to visit those. I used my records when they were up in Bellingham. I drove up there. And, you know, so he used his own records, right, that he had turned in 1962. And, you know, I said to him, Louis, they're over in Bellevue. You know, you could go visit them. I used your records. They have your name on them, special events. And he's like, yeah, I think I will. So anyway, one person looking ahead, right? One person looking ahead. And maybe somebody else would have done it. Maybe there was a plan, but maybe not. And it's interesting to me that Ewan Dingwall, who was the general manager of the fair, he left right before the 1962 World's Fair ended. And he left because he got hired to be the first director of Century 21 Inc., which was the private group that managed the Seattle Center for a few years before the city had to take over. And when he left, he took his fair records with him, and these are at the University of Washington, and they're really fabulous because Ewan Dingwall was the very first person hired to work on that fair. And then he left at practically the end of the fair. So his records are the records of the fair, you know, from one funneled through one person's office and one person's perspective. They're very, very useful. And UW also has Eddie Carlson's papers. Eddie Carlson was the volunteer exposition first president, and he was in charge of the World's Fair Commission during the entire course of planning all the way to the fair being over. And he was the person who thought up the idea for the Space Needle. That's kind of a famous apocryphal story. And his work was voluntary, and it wasn't his only project. He had lots of other stuff going on, and UW has papers for all kinds of things on Eddie Carlson, but it has this scrapbook that, well, it's called the Eddie Carlson scrapbook. I'm thinking he probably had his secretary doing the clipping. He was running Western Hotels, and, you know, I don't think he was clipping himself. I love the thought that he might have been, but I don't think so. And then the other thing that's at UW on this fair, which is really significant, is the fair president, Joseph Gandy. Joseph Gandy, without whom I think the fair probably never would have come all the way to fruition, because he was an interesting guy. He was an attorney. He was a Ford salesman. And he was Seafair, the King Neptune 1 year, very active in all kinds of civic things, and a salesman more than anything else. And he was the guy who went out there and sold that fair around the world and brought in a lot of foreign participation. And that's a way bigger story. That's like my cliff notes to Joe Gandhi. But the thing that's the most important to me about Joe Gandhi's records at the University of Washington is that it also includes a little group of papers from his wife, Lorene Gandhi, and papers that address the wives or sisters or daughters or female secretaries of these really men during this era exclusively who planned and left a record on these fairs. They're just rare, incredibly rare. So the fact that there's this little bunch of Lorene Gandhi's records there is huge. And Lorene Gandhi was, you know, an unsung hero of that fair. She had a schedule on the fairgrounds every single day. She entertained, her daughter told me, two and sometimes three times a day for the entire course of the fair. She was always in charge of visiting dignitaries' wives and families. Of course, she was not paid for any of this, right? This is 1962. Very gracious. Later went on to found the Seattle Center Foundation and be very important in the Seattle Center. And so he died. Joe Gandhi died less than 10 years after the fair was over. And it was Lorene who decided to donate his records. And so she got to choose what she was going to donate, right? Again, you know, who donated them and when did they donate them and why am I looking at this particular thing? Was there another thing that didn't get donated? Well, so what Lorene decided to donate was these interesting things besides all of his papers. There are things like the cover, and I'm doing this from memory, so if you go back and look, Blynn, and you're like, wait, that's not there then. But as I recall, the cover of their Seattle phone directory with all these interesting notes that had to do with the fair, like, you know, oh yes, I'll tell him that meeting is blah, blah, blah. And people's names and phone numbers and children's names so that invitations could go out to wives' names, not always easy to find in 1962. You know, Mrs. Ewan Dingwall, what was her first name? Well, we know, but it's not always that easy to find that out. The fair directory that lists all the staffers and their titles and just explains sort of how the department structure changed over time as you look at different ones of those. His correspondence on the fair and protocol records, which are so, so important. The fair had this protocol department where the director was sent by the State Department so that they could handle all of these diplomatic visitors that came to the fair without, you know, some horrible faux pas that would have, you know, landed us in trouble with, you know, Great Britain or Iran or any of the other countries that came. So interestingly enough, the person who helped Lorene Gandhi put together the records that she donated to the University of Washington Special Collections was this woman named Patricia Balarjan. And we interviewed Patricia for the book. She's still with us, and she became the assistant in the protocol office of the fair after she had finished being Eleanor Roosevelt's assistant at the United Nations. So Pat understood how important it was to create a record for future history, for future historians. I mean, that was, she gets that. So accepting donations from people who want to make them is obvious. Making donations, as I said, if you have something you think just might be important. And then how about soliciting materials from key fair players, in this fair especially? There are still materials out there. And they matter to the people who have them right now, who are participants in the fair. Will they matter to their heirs? I don't know. Anytime I get a chance to suggest that, hey, that material is really important, you ought to think about putting that in one of our archives, you know. I mean, I can only push so hard, but it seems like there might be some kind of a way to sort of open up dialogue during the course of the celebration of the 62 fair to try to be sure that those materials end up safe so that when, you know, whoever's writing the 75th anniversary book and the 100th anniversary book has them to look at too. So
because of how we marked the 1909 fair and how we're marking the 1962 fair, as I said, I think that the community has learned very, very much about the importance of these festivals and fairs and about what needs to be in the collections, and that we should be able to gather up materials more efficiently for the fairs and festivals of tomorrow. There are people who are already doing this kind of thing. Eleanor Tews, how do you say Eleanor's last name at Seattle Public Schools Archives? Tews. Eleanor Tews, this amazing archivist at Seattle Public Schools, she goes out when a school is closing, okay, Roosevelt's closing, they're gonna, you know, redo it, so everybody's gonna go away and everything's gonna be empty from the building for 2 years. She goes with her boxes and she's like, okay, put the stuff in here, the important stuff, put it in here, that's the dumpster, no, put it in my box. And she takes it away and saves it. And I think sometimes it takes that kind of act of going out and making it easy for whoever it is that's doing that thing, closing down their building or whatever, make it easy for them. Or Jeanette here at the Public Library, who makes a point of finding things, records that are normally only digital, and she will print them out and she will put them in the collection here. So whatever happened to the digital, happens to the digital format of that item, I think it's City Council minutes in the future. You know, we don't know, but we've got a printout here, a hard copy, and that's going to be really, really useful in 10 years or 50 years, just like the records from 100 years ago are incredibly important right now. So I guess my main point is that if we use a really wide net in gathering the archival materials when they conclude and not decades later, and by plan and not by chance, and if we capture oral history sooner rather than later, we are going to be able to create a better treasure trove. And it really is a treasure trove for anybody, professional researchers, the grandchildren of those people who were important, who get interested and say, what was that, that you know, what was that she did? And just for public in general. And fairs and festivals tell us so much about our community. They tell us, you know, how we plan the fairs and how we fund them and how we solicit participation in them and how we manage the daily details. It creates a record of these events, but not only that, it's about how our own unique and very specific communities come together, person by person, vote by vote, crank letter by crank letter, right? It tells a story. And it builds something that in time historians and of all kinds will be able to sift through and analyze and validate and value. So fairs and festivals, they're discrete events, right? They have a start. Let's have a fair. They have a big, messy middle that's the planning process and the fair itself and what happens at that. And then they have a closing ceremony. And it's done. They close the books and it's over. We should be able to gather that kind of record that tells the whole story of these kinds of events and have them there and preserve that whole record. And I think that we owe it to the future to be sure that that happens. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
You know, I'm saying, look at everything you throw out. Obviously, not everything is going to be saved. Although, it's funny, I've found things in University of Washington that taught me something about the person. Once there was this folder for this Seattle art dealer, and the folder was labeled ephemera. And I thought, And it looked like someone had taken the junk drawer in her kitchen and turned it upside down into this folder. But it was great! There was all kinds of stuff in there that told me more about that woman than all my reading of the rest of the files. So, you know, some of it, I think, should get saved. Other questions? Okay. So thank you all so much for coming today. My next project right now is going to be promoting the heck out of this book, because this book was written for the Seattle Center Foundation, and their point in all of it is to help people understand how important this fair was and how the most important legacy of this fair was the Seattle Center, and that's all of ours, and we all have to, you know, take care of it and plan for it. And so they have this program called The Next 50, which is what's going to happen in the next 50 years. So I'm helping with that right now. Beyond that, I don't know. We'll see. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.